Welcome to the Series 7 Study Guide. My name is Franz. As you know, this podcast is giving you samples of the full audio course, which is 58 lessons in length and over 25 hours for the Series 7 exam. Now, once you pass the Series 7 exam, there's probably, well, there will be several other exams that you need to pass, and they include the Series 63 exam. Possibly for your firm, it might be the Series 67 exam. And if you're going to be selling annuities or talking to your clients about insurance products, then you're going to have to pass the insurance life health exam. Now, this is a state exam, and it's administered by your state because insurance is regulated state by state. And of course, you've learned that if you've taken the full Series 7 study guide, audio series of lessons in the study guide, or if you just passed the exam already, you know that. Well, to help you pass the life health exam, I put together, just like this, an audio course for you. And it's 12 hours in length, it's 26 lessons, and an additional 4 review lessons to bring the total number of audio files to 30. Now, the purpose of this course is not meant to replace your classroom time. In fact, most likely you're going to be required to sit in a classroom to even take the exam. I know that was the case when I took the insurance exam many years ago. But again, the purpose of the audio course is to allow you to study while you're commuting, exercising, or just going for a walk. You're not tied to a desk or tied to a chair to read a book. And it'll help you reinforce the material that you're learning in the class and in the book. So just like with the Series 7 podcast, I'm going to give you some sample lessons, and then if they make sense for you, then you might want to consider purchasing the full audio course at the website. Now, I'm going to put this audio course at the Series 7 podcast website, and also I'm setting up a new website, which is called the insuranceexampodcast.com, and you'll be able to download it there or purchase it there, either place. But again, this is an exam that you may or may not have to pass, depending on if you're going to be selling insurance products. So I'm going to give you 5 sample lessons at this podcast. And if it makes sense for you, go to the website, series7podcast.com, and go to the audio study products, and there will be a link to be able to purchase this series of lessons. Or you might go to the insuranceexampodcast.com and purchase it at that website. As you can see, the path I'm going down is basically professional audio courses for the professional to help them pass various exams along the way. But I do have one other series of podcasts that I've talked about before that if you're interested in, you might take a look at. You know my passion is sailing, and I spend about 2 months every year sailing in the Mediterranean, taking my clients sailing with me, and I have a podcast called Sailing in the Mediterranean and Beyond, and that's over at medsailor.com. And I put together a series of audio lessons there to help you pass the ASA 101. That's the American Sailing Association Exam 101, which is basic keelboat certification. The 103, which is the basic coastal cruising certification. And the ASA 104, which is the bareboat certification. Now, the reason people try to get these certifications is nowadays, if you want to go charter a boat, a bareboat charter, in some exotic location, most of the charter companies require that you have one of 2 certifications or one of 3 certifications. The American Sailing Association is one of those certifications that is accepted by most charter companies. But again, I have a lot of podcasts over there just talking about my adventures sailing in the Mediterranean. So if that's of interest to you, check it out. And that's at medsailor.com. All right, let's get on to the insurance Life Health Exam Sample Audio Lessons.
Welcome to this lesson entitled Underwriting Basics. In this lesson, we're going to be talking about the underwriting process, which is basically the process through which a person called an underwriter determines first whether a person is insurable, and second, at what rate the person should be charged for insurance that is offered. So this is an extremely important job at an insurance company. Depending on how well the underwriter does, the company is going to either gain or lose money. So it's very important for them to follow a very strict set of guidelines when determining which risks are okay for the company to take on and which risks are not okay for the company to take. Once a person agrees to purchase an insurance contract, three things happen. The first is that the process of underwriting is set in motion. The application gets submitted and is then either approved or denied, and the producer then delivers the product to the policy holder. There are four different roles that a person can have regarding an insurance policy. Most of the time, these are the same person, but they could theoretically be four different people. The first role is that of the applicant, and that's just the person who fills out the application, whoever does the paperwork and says that they want the insurance policy. Then we have the policy owner, who is the person who pays the premium. So often this is the applicant, but in some cases, such as when your employer might provide insurance, the policy owner is actually the employer, even if you are technically the applicant. So they're the people that pay the premiums. Then we have the insured, and that's the person who is covered by the policy. So in the case of, say, a life insurance policy, the insured would be the person who would have to die in order for the life insurance policy to go into effect. And then finally, the beneficiary, and those are the people who benefit from the policy. And often the beneficiary is also the insured. But sometimes, as in life insurance, the person who dies is not the person who benefits from the policy, it's the surviving people who are the beneficiaries of the policy. They receive money on the event of the certain person's death. So to review, that's the applicant, the policy owner, the insured, and the beneficiary. Those are the four roles that a person can have. Now let's go back to talking about the underwriting process itself. Now this underwriting process must be completed before a policy can be issued. And those who do it, as I mentioned at the beginning, are called underwriters. They have to assess the risks that the company will take on and decide which risks are acceptable and which are not. They're trying to protect the insurance company by making sure that they take on a variety of risks and that none of these risks are too likely to cause serious financial harm to the company. So they have to all decide that there are some risks that are just too risky to insure at any price, or they have to also ensure that the things that are riskier are insured at a higher price. When talking about life or health insurance, the underwriter must first review an applicant's medical and other history so that they can decide two things. First, whether or not the applicant will be accepted based on this history, and second, whether the person will be charged at the regular rate or a modified rate based on how much risk they pose to the company. So the modified rate is usually a higher rate that says the risk is greater, and so we're going to charge you more. For example, if someone had a very dangerous profession, let's say they worked in construction and were operating heavy machinery all the time, that might pose a higher risk than, say, someone who works in an office environment. And so they might have to pay a higher premium in order to offset that risk to the company. That's just an example. There's also things, certain medical conditions that can make you harder to insure because you pose greater risks. Also, as you get older, you have a greater risk of either contracting serious illness or dying. And so often older people pose more of a risk and have to pay higher premiums for insurance. The main focus of what an underwriter is doing is to avoid adverse selection. Now recall that this term means that the company takes on a risk that is most likely to result in a loss for a company. That's adverse selection. So they want to avoid that whenever possible. If they take on something that causes adverse selection, then they haven't done their job properly. These are individuals who are more likely to experience loss than others, such as those who are seriously ill. The underwriter must determine if a higher premium must be paid to offset the loss or whether the application should be denied because the risk can't be covered at any cost. The underwriter uses various sources of information to determine whether a person is eligible and at what rate. These include the information provided on the application that the applicant fills out themselves, so they can self-identify some of these factors. They also come from things like medical history records, physician statements, consumer reports, information from the Medical Information Bureau, and credit reports. So they're not only looking for medical things, things that might cause them to be sick or injured or have some sort of risk factor, but they're also looking at their temperament. They're looking at whether they've paid their bills, whether they have good credit, just to see all these things that can make them more or less risky. So it's really a complicated process in a lot of cases. It's not just a simple glance over someone's background before they make a decision. When dealing with insurance, you have to remember there are very large sums of money at stake. With health insurance, there can be extremely high costs for certain procedures. For life insurance, replacing someone's income for a number of years is also extremely expensive. And automobile insurance, cars are expensive just by nature. An underwriter's responsibility is so vital to the survival of an insurance company. Taking all of that into account, it makes sense that it's in the best interest of insurance companies to get an application that is as accurate as possible so that informed decisions can be made. An application is divided into various sections in order to get specific kinds of information. Part one of the application usually consists just about general information over the client. This includes contact information such as name, address, social security number, and other general information such as marital status. This is just to sort of lay a foundation. It provides some useful information, but is really only touches the surface. Part two of the application provides information about a person's medical history, their current medical state, and their personal morals, such as the use of alcohol, tobacco, drugs, or other dangerous substances, and other dangerous personal hobbies. Some insurance is not medical in nature, and so this part will be modified to include other pertinent information instead. Now, this may seem like it's delving really deep into a person's life, but all of these things can cause risk. For example, if you're giving someone insurance, either medical insurance or auto insurance, a person's use of alcohol can cause problems. If a person uses alcohol and drives, that can cause car accidents. If a person uses alcohol over a long period of time, it can cause liver damage and other problems that may cause them to use their medical insurance more than someone who didn't drink alcohol. And so that's why things like this are extremely important to know on this phase of the application. When medical information is required as part of the application, an attending physician statement is often attached to Part 2. Now, this is just a statement that helps the insurance company learn more about a person's current condition and to make sure that no undisclosed risks have been overlooked. So this is usually written by a physician that is familiar with the client, someone who's seen them multiple times and can talk about any potential problems. It's also making sure that a person doesn't just self-identify all their problems and leave out something that's important. So getting a professional opinion that helps insurance companies feel better about making their decisions based on what is in that letter. When a person applies for a great deal of insurance, a person might be required to undergo a specific medical examination in order for more specific information to be obtained. So they actually might say, okay, before we can finish underwriting this claim, you have to go see a physician and be seen about these specific things. It's usually in areas where there's a concern. And so if that is included, then more documentation is attached to Part 2 about the specific visit. Now, it seems like some of these questions are a little bit invasive, but there are limits as to what questions can and cannot be asked. For example, specific questions about a person's sexual orientation can't be asked. That's one thing that is out of bounds. Though you can ask a person if that person has experienced AIDS, because this is an important consideration when talking about medical decisions. A person who has AIDS is at a higher risk of either becoming sicker or even dying from the disease. So you can ask about a person's actual lifestyle, but you can ask about specific medical conditions. So there is a distinction put there. After the medical information, an agent's statement is often attached. This statement includes disclosing the relationship between the agent and the insured and any personal knowledge the agent has about the client. Often agents will do business with people that they know. They will try to get referrals also from current clients in order to build their base. And so often there is some sort of relationship between the agent and the client. And any information that the underwriter can get is helpful. So the agent often attaches this sort of statement, giving what information he or she can. Depending on the kind of insurance that's being sought, the underwriter can actually order investigations into a person's credit and personal morals from other agencies. And there are specific agencies that investigate credit and do background checks and find out more about people so that these kind of informed decisions can be made. These agencies often interview a person's personal and professional references. Now, a personal reference is just somebody who knows the person closely, who's been their friend or a family member and has had close dealings with them. A professional reference, however, is somebody usually that they've been employed by, that they've worked with, someone that can talk about that sort of aspect of their lives. So they talk to both kinds of people in order to establish a sort of more well-rounded picture of the person. Because many people are actually quite different at work versus how they are just at home or among friends. Now, once all of this has been done, all of these statements from the physician and from the agent or any investigations or medical records, then both the agent and the applicant sign the application, saying that they understand everything that has been put in here. When investigating potential clients, underwriters must still abide by what are called HIPAA laws. That's H-I-P-A-A. Now, these are laws that govern the protection of medical information. Through every stage of the investigation, an insurance company must protect the privacy of everyone that is involved. If an investigation turns up something medically relevant, the client must be notified and then can choose how that information is shared. And also, when somebody comes up with information, they can only share it with people and agencies who have a genuine need to know about that information. At the end of the contract, an underwriter then delivers and explains the policy, then it collects the initial premium and offers a receipt to the client. So if that is accepted, the underwriter says, okay, this is a risk that we are willing to take on. Here's the premium. Go ahead and pay the premium. I'll give you a receipt. And at that moment, the contract is sealed, that it comes into effect and it's good. After the application is complete, there can actually be amendments made to the application. And any of these changes have to be initialed by the client and often by the agent as well. Usually on the contract, they write their initials saying, okay, I saw this change, I approve this change. So that can happen, though it doesn't always happen. When looking at a person as a potential client, the underwriter considers different kinds of risks, such as the following. Standard risks. Standard risks have a normal probability of occurring, which means that they can be insured at the normal premium rate. Most risks are standard risks, and so most people get the regular price. Then we have what are called substandard risks. These have a higher than normal probability of occurring, which means they must have a higher insurance rate. The premium charged must be higher. This often occurs from factors about individuals such as poor health or risky habits that puts them into the substandard risks category, which means their premiums go up. Then there are what are called preferred risks. These risks, on the other hand, have a lower possibility of happening and can be often insured at a discounted rate. For example, a person who has a spotless driving record over many years is seen as less likely to have an automobile accident and thus might receive a discount. They are rewarded for providing less risk to the company and so get a lower rate than most people. Then we have what are called declined risks. And these are risks that are just so high that an insurer will not cover them at any price. Now, these are pretty rare because most things can be insured at a certain price. It's going to be high, but there will be a certain price. Well, there are just a few things that are absolutely declined risks that can't be insured no matter what. So those four kinds of risks, again, are standard risks, substandard risks, preferred risks, and declined risks. The final part of the underwriting process, once they've decided that they're going to go ahead and approve the application, is determining the amount of a person's premium. There are three factors that influence how much a premium is going to be. That's mortality and morbidity. That's one factor together. Interest and expenses. Let's talk about each one of these categories and how that relates to an insurance company. Mortality is used when talking about life insurance, and morbidity when talking about health insurance. So you usually just use one or the other, depending on what kind of insurance you're talking about. The mortality rate is a number based on a person's age that shows how many people among 1,000 people of that same age die at that age. This helps determine how much a person should be charged. Naturally, the mortality rate rises with age, as do the premiums. So the older you get, the more you're going to have to pay for life insurance because the probability that you're going to die at that age increases as time goes on. So it's much more expensive to insure somebody at 60 or 70 years old than it is to insure somebody at 30 or 40 years old. Health insurance policies are a little bit more difficult to calculate because they're based on different kinds of statistics, but especially these morbidity statistics. Morbidity is not the same as mortality. Mortality means death. Morbidity is the likelihood that a person will require medical care, usually because they've contracted a disease or sustained an injury. So morbidity is illness or injury. Mortality is fatal. Older people also usually have a higher rate of morbidity as well as mortality, and those in certain dangerous professions also have a higher morbidity rate, which means that people in these groups are required to pay more in their premiums. Insurance companies also need to consider how much money they will have to pay out when somebody becomes sick or injured and how often this might happen. And that's called the claim frequency rate. The claim frequency rate is just saying how often is this person likely to submit a claim. And the higher that rate is, usually the higher the amount of their premium is as well. Now, typically, insurance companies take in premium payments before claims are paid out. This means that companies can invest money in order to make more money and keep premiums as low as possible. They use interest that they calculate that they will earn when deciding how much to charge. So let's say they take in $100,000. All of the claims aren't going to come out at once. So they take a portion of that money, that $100,000, and they invest it. And in that investment, they get a certain percentage of that as interest. And this interest can be added to the original $100,000, in which case they can use that money to keep premium rates down. So the more interest they're able to earn, the lower premiums they are able to offer to their clients. So that's the second thing that they have to consider. After mortality and morbidity, they consider how much interest they're able to make so that they can offset some of those costs. Now, the third thing they need to take into account are operating expenses. It's not enough to make sure that you have enough money to pay out claims. An insurance company is a company. It's a business. They've got overhead costs. They have to make sure they can pay their operating expenses throughout the entire year. Things like renting the space that they work out of, the electricity and utilities, the salaries of the people who work there. These are all operating expenses. Now, they load the costs into the premiums to make sure that they stay solvent. So insurance premiums are a little bit higher just because these companies have to cover their operating costs. And there are several different costs that are lumped into these operating costs. First, we have acquisition costs. And acquisition costs are the cost that the company incurs in order to bring policies into effect. These costs must be recouped usually over a period of years because they're quite high. They have to pay the underwriters, they have to pay for investigations and all sorts of different legal things so that these acquisition costs are pretty high. One of the highest parts of this, however, is actually the first year commission for the producer, the agent who is able to seal this deal. For this reason, insurance companies don't want a policy to just be for a short time. They want it to go over for a few years so that they can recoup their money over time. The next category is called general overhead, and that just is the physical overhead of running a company, such as the facilities, the furniture, the salaries, the utilities, all of those things. Contingency funds are often worked in to give the company a little breathing room against difficult or unforeseen circumstances. Think of it as kind of a savings account against a rainy day. Most policies don't allow premiums to be increased once the policy has been issued. If it ends up costing more to the insurance company, they can't actually raise the premiums for that person. So they'd like to have a little bit to fall back on just in case. Another thing to consider is that claims have to be paid immediately after they are determined to be valid, and they're paid throughout the year, and not all at the end of the year. There needs to be sufficient funds to pay claims as they come up. Often the premiums will be paid over the course of 12 months or every few months, whatever the contract says, but all of the money doesn't usually come up front. Though claims happen all throughout the year. So they have to, once again, make sure that there's some breathing room just in case a lot of claims come due all at the same time. So those are all things to consider when the underwriter decides how much they need to charge for the premiums. Let's talk a little bit more about those premiums. There's a term called the gross annual premium, and that's the actual amount a person pays over the course of the year for their policy. It's calculated based on the following formula. The gross premium is equal to the mortality rate minus interest plus expenses. So the mortality rate or morbidity rate, if you're talking about health insurance, minus interest, so these are ways they can recoup money, plus the expenses. So factored in all of these things, you get the premium rate. The net premium rate is calculated by a slightly different formula. That's just net premium equals mortality minus interest. This one doesn't adjust for expenses. So these are two formulas that underwriters use to actually figure out what they should be charging. There's also another term you might need to know that's called a level premium. And this is a different kind of premium where the early years of the policies are overcharged and the later years of the policies are undercharged, so that the increasing rate of mortality can be compensated for, so that the premium remains the same over time generally. Another thing to keep in mind is the premium mode, which is the frequency at which the premium is paid. The more fragmented the payments, the higher the premium. So the difference between paying your premium in 12 monthly installments, as opposed to paying it maybe twice a year in two larger installments, or just paying it once annually in a single large payment. The more often you pay it, the higher the premium actually has to be. That's because the company makes more interest on the premium if it's paid in a single sum up front than if the payment is broken up. If it is broken up, the company has to compensate for the lost interest they would have made if they had received a single payment. So it's actually, if you can pay your insurance all at one time, you're going to save some money. Finally, we have what are called loss ratios. This is another thing that underwriters often calculate. and that's simply the losses divided out by the premiums. Let me give you an example to make that a little bit clearer. For example, if a company experiences $5 million in losses that they paid out through claims, but they take in $20 million paid in premiums, the loss ratio would be 25%. You divide 20 million by 5 million, and that gives you a 25% loss ratio, which is good because they took in more in premiums than they paid out in losses. The expense ratio is also something that can be calculated, which are the operating expenses divided by the premiums. For example, if the company's expenses were $4 million and they collected $20 million in premiums, then their expense ratio is only 20%, which is pretty good. So they're taking in a lot more money than they're giving out. So that's always what the company wants to do. 100% expense ratio means that the company has broken even. They gave out exactly as much money as they brought in, which is usually not what they want. They want to make money. A higher than 100% ratio means that they lost money, and a lower than 100% ratio means that they made a profit. So that's what they want, lower than 100% on that. That brings us to the end of this lesson. I hope you understand a little bit more about the job of an underwriter and some of the things that they have to take into consideration. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening. Again, if this makes sense, if you like the teaching style, if it's helping you learn, consider buying the full series of lessons by going to audio products at theseries7podcast.com or go over and check out the insuranceexampodcast.com. They should be available at both sites, but the Insurance Exam Podcast website at this point in time, at this recording, is a work in progress, and it may or may not be available there yet. Just check it out, and if it is, that's fine. If not, buy them under audio products at theseries7podcast.com. Thanks for listening. If you have any thoughts, comments, suggestions, write me, Franz at theseries7podcast.com. Good luck in your studies.